Are you bringing over? All right, so I've got Mr. Beam and Mr. Svensson aboard. I'm not sure if your camera sharing will work or not, but we do at least have you on screen with the panelists.
Okay, there's Jim.
And Mr. Beam, are you able to unmute yourself? There we go. Got a camera.
And Amanda, when you have an opportunity, we have the Watershed Company waiting in the attendees room.
Okay. Okay, I was going to bring them over when we got to that agenda item.
Perfect. Okay. All right. We're live now.
We are live. We're ready to go.
Okay. Call the meeting to order. This is the regular meeting of the Kitsap County Planning Commission, Tuesday, December 1st at 5:33 p.m. We'll start with agenda item A, introductions, and let's start in the south end. Who do we have down south? Jim.
Jim Svensson, South Kitsap. Greetings.
Great. Glad you could make it. Okay. And of course, we have a vacancy with Ed Galloway, but we have Kim Allen.
Kim Allen, South Kitsap. Good evening.
Great. And in Central, Alan?
Alan Beam, Central.
Okay. Mike Eliason, Central. And Richard Shattuck emailed us and said, unfortunately, he cannot be here this evening. Now on to North, Joe.
Joe Phillips, North Kitsap.
And Amy.
Amy Mall, North Kitsap.
Great. And last but not least, Aaron.
Aaron Murphy, North Kitsap.
Great. Thank you, everyone. Item B, virtual meeting protocol. Pretty straightforward. For members of the public that want to participate later during general public comment, please refer to page 2 of the agenda that gives you the details on how to participate by internet and by phone. Item C, adoption of agenda. Are there any additions or corrections to the agenda as presented? Okay, seeing and hearing none, is there a motion to approve the agenda as presented?
So moved.
Okay, and motion to approve. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, motion and second. All those in favor of approving the agenda as presented, say aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any in opposition? Any abstentions? Motion carries. Item D, adoption of minutes. The November 17th minutes are not available right now. Hopefully we'll have those at the next meeting. Item E, general public comment. This is the opportunity for members of the public to provide comments about any subject that's not on tonight's meeting agenda. We'll check with the clerk if we have anyone.
I don't see any hands raised.
And we have attendees, so let me begin. Mentioned for internet users, you want to click and raise your hand with the hand feature. And if you're call in, you want to hit *9 to participate.
All right. Still seeing none.
Okay. Then we'll move on to item F, briefing, Shoreline Master Program update. Kirby.
If
welcome.
You allow me, planning commissioners, I'll kick it off and then hand it off to Kirby if that's okay with everyone.
Sounds great.
Okay. First and foremost, I hope everyone had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday, and hopefully everyone was had an opportunity to step back, even though how interesting of the year 2020 was, step back and still recognize what the things we are grateful for. So I know I definitely did, and put me in perspective of what happened over the course of 2020 so far. So, but before we jump into the agenda item where Ms. Kirby will lead us through on tonight's agenda is review and discussion of the Shoreline Master Program periodic update, specifically the consistency analysis. when most of the staff present tonight should not look too unfamiliar to the Planning Commission. I think Mr. Dan Nickel with the Watershed Company is sitting in the attendees that will be joining our conversation shortly. Or, hey Dan, welcome, sir. As well as prior to this evening, we've had a series of briefings with the Planning Commission on the Shoreline Master Program or SMP purpose, intent, the focus of the periodic update, the short schedule and milestones to get to our June 30th, 2021 deadline, but also an overview of the public participation plan that was approved by the commissioners not too long ago. But tonight is where we kind of gear things up to set in motion the start of the formal public review and comment process that the Planning Commission will be integral in that involvement and will be undergoing that in the coming months. This pretty much sets the foundation of what will be part of the Commission's formal public comment, deliberation, recommendation, and findings of facts related to the SMP periodic update. While Ms. Kirby will go over next step schedule milestones during her presentation, but in the start of this discussion last week on November 23rd, specifically, the department did meet with the Board of County Commissioners to review the packet materials that you have before you and setting kind of the work plan and topic sideboards for preparing the draft amendments to the SMP, which starts this formal legislative process. The Planning Commission's packet provided, I believe was last week, should reflect the commissioners' discussion and revisions to what that work plan should look like in areas where staff and our consultant will be focusing on the preparation of that draft. Specifically in your packet are two attachments. I hope folks did have some time to take a look, but we'll be walking through that shortly. But attachment one is really a very brief summary matrix of the topics covered in the consistency analysis, which is attachment two, which is the consistency analysis that uses Ecology's checklist format and goes far more in depth on the rationale behind the work plan items before us. With that, before Kirby launches into the matrices, any questions for me, Planning Commissioners? Hearing none, Ms. Kirby, would you like to kick it off and lead us through? And again, this is intended to be kind of a back and forth discussion. We've reserved plenty of time to walk through the matrices with the commissioners and answer any questions you may have.
My pleasure, Angie. Thank you. And for the record, my name is Kirby Messablu-Yobek, Associate Environmental Planner with the Department of Community Development, Kitsap County. Like Angie described, I'll be can you raise your hand if you can see my screen? The scoping matrix? Perfect. Mm-hmm. So what I'll do tonight is I'll go through and review the scoping matrix, which is a shortened, distilled version of the consistency analysis that really just captures the mandatory changes or proposed changes, the recommended changes, both by Ecology, and also the discretionary recommendations from internal staff to help clarify improve the functionality and application of the Shoreline Master Program. So I'll go through each of these. You can see the table, it's the columns highlight the topics, the actions, and then the originator. So you can see that it's either state or DCD that originated this proposed amendment. So I'll start at the top, topic number one, which it includes all the mandatory actions by Ecology, and mandatory meaning these are revisions that are required for consistency with state laws. Recommended actions by Ecology means or indicate revisions that would improve consistency with state laws but are not strictly required. So I'll start again. Topic number one, consistency with state law, starting at the top bullet. And I'll run through these. Feel free, at the end of each section, I'll stop for questions and discussion. But I know you might lose your thoughts, so feel free to interject and we can jump into it. So I'll go right ahead. First mandatory action by Ecology is to cite or reference updated cost threshold for freshwater dock constructions for exemptions to the substantial development permit. The second mandatory action is to cite the updated cost threshold for exemptions to substantial development permit as well. That number went up to $7,047. The next mandatory action is to add reference and list statutory exceptions for local review by the county. These include things like remedial actions, boatyard improvements to meet stormwater permit requirements, as well as Department of Transportation, facility maintenance, and safety improvements. The next mandatory action is to revise language in the Shoreline Master Program to include shoreline permit exemptions for retrofitting existing structures to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. The next mandatory action is to update the superseded critical areas ordinance references, which references to the 2017 critical areas ordinance. And this, I will add that there's an additional element to this, which I will get to in the following recommended actions. The next mandatory action is to list all lakes and streams in shoreline jurisdiction in the Shoreline Master Program. These are already are currently listed in the 2010 Shoreline Inventory and Characterization Report. So this exercise would just transfer those that list into the Shoreline Master Program. So those constitute the mandatory actions by ecology based on ecology's checklist and establishes kind of the bookends to the proposed code amendments, at least for this first topic. I'll stop there for any questions or comments before I move on to the recommended actions.
Commissioner Allen?
Just a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Was 2017 the year that the CAO was first adopted in Kitsap County, or was it before then?
It was before then, Commissioner Allen, and it was subsequently updated in 2007, and then subsequently updated in 2017, if I got my timetables correct.
Yes, the current references to 2007 CAO, and so this proposed code amendment is to reference the most up-to-date CAO, which was adopted in 2017, July.
Okay, very good, thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions about section one? Okay, I don't see any. Okay, go ahead and proceed.
Okay, so moving on to topic number two, which is again, promote consistency with state laws, but these are the recommended actions by ecology, and recommended indicates revisions that would improve consistency but are not strictly required. And so starting at the top bullet point under the recommended actions, first is to revise the definition of development to clarify that development does not include dismantling or removing structures. The second recommended action is to revise language to clarify that forest practices that involve only timber cutting are not considered developments under the Shoreline Management Act and does not require a substantial development permit. The next recommended action is to clarify that the Shoreline Management Act does not apply to lands under exclusive federal jurisdiction. The next recommended action is to define special procedures for Washington State Department of Transportation projects for WAC 173-27-125. This essentially establishes a 90-day target for local review of Department of Transportation projects. The next recommended action is to add definition and policy for floating homes permitted or legally established prior to January 1st, 2011. The next recommended action. There we go. Is to revise existing floodway definition for consistency with FEMA regulations. And then this is where I'm going to jump into the topic number three, which is consistency with Department of Ecology wetland guidance. Again, this is the section where we talked about referencing the most up-to-date critical areas ordinance. That was adopted in 2017. However, 1 year later, Ecology provided additional guidance on wetland buffers. And so I will stop there and ask Dan and Angie and our staff to elaborate a little bit more on this recommended action.
Hey, Kirby, can you bring up the section of the consistency analysis that kind of walks everyone through what yes. this means, not necessarily relate changing to buffers, but scores?
Yes.
And how you derive to a buffer. Hey, Dan, you articulate this far better than I. Do you want to take a stab and we can jump in?
Yeah, and at least provide a little bit on the background and what Ecology's logic is on this.
Sure thing. Ecology in 2018, they came out with a revised guidance on the wetland buffer protection standards. And this was actually a recalibration of an effort that they did in 2014. So they had an old rating system, a wetland rating system in 2004 that they updated in 2014. And the intent of that update was to look at a number of different wetland types throughout the state and develop a buffer system that would protect, with a new rating system that would offer the similar level of protection that they had in 2004. And so they came out with that system in 2014. And in 2018, they actually went back and did a recalibration of that effort. And what they found was that in the rating system, they use various scores for things such as water quality or habitat. And they found that what they do is they rate habitat values from a score of 3 to 9. And they found that they've categorized low functioning or low habitat functions and moderate habitat functions and high habitat functions with these scoring systems between 3 and 9. And what they found through this calibration effort was that a habitat score of 5 essentially was more similar to a low functioning habitat score of 3 to 4 and rather than in a closer to a moderate level of function of 6 to 7. And what this did was essentially the table that you're looking at here is a summary of the tables that are actually in your current critical areas ordinance. There's a number of tables in that document that speak to the types of land use, low, moderate, and high land use, and the corresponding buffers to protect the various types of wetlands. And so by the recalibration of these wetland buffers by Ecology, what this does to the county's tables here is it essentially moves any wetland that has a habitat score of 5, it would move it to a lower rating, which essentially relates to a lower buffer distance. And so you'll see here in the table that Kirby has pulled up here, the yellow highlights here are identifying areas in which this table would change. And so the area that she's pointing to here for a category 1 moderate level of function for habitat, the change would be from instead of saying 5 to 7 points, it would be 6 to 7 points. And the anything that had a habitat score of 5 would now be tossed down into the lower functioning buffer. And so essentially it's lowering buffer distances for those particular wetlands. It doesn't happen very often that Ecology comes out with guidance that actually reduces wetland buffers, but in fact, this is what happened. They've been made very clear that their recalibration, and this is important to understand, and that the recalibration does not mean that it's reducing the protection of these wetlands. What they're saying is that these wetlands that score a habitat score of 5 are actually low functioning and deserve and only need to have the smaller value for wetland buffer protection. So I'd classify this as a recalibration for consistency with the guidance to make sure that we are protecting the wetlands appropriately. It does offer some development relief because those wetlands that do score a value of 5 will actually essentially have a lower buffer than they would have otherwise.
So for additional context, as applications come in, again, all the kind of the wetland delineations and categorizations use ecologies form to determine that scoring process. So the scale and scope of wet potential relief, whether this for economic or housing purposes, would be determined on a parcel by parcel, site by site circumstance. In addition to that, for context and what was part of kind of the Board of County Commissioners conversation was, is this is an opportunity to kind of seek that relief in advance when we are mandatory to update our critical areas ordinance, which is not until 2025. So that was kind of the nuance in the back and forth discussion and whether or not we want to crack open Title 19 as part of the SMP periodic update. Any questions thus far for staff or for Mr. Nickel? Concerns? Should we all be running to the hills and opening up the critical areas ordinance as part of this update? I had my fair share of concerns when I kind of thought about this and what this would mean, but also stepping back and seeing what, again, the relief, and sometimes this is brought up during application review and the guidance and why our current critical areas ordinance does not reflect that.
Okay, I have one. I want to know, the bullet says clarify that the SMA does not apply to lands under exclusive federal jurisdiction. I thought that was in the previously approved SMA. What's the clarification?
Ms. Kirby, you want to tackle that?
Do you have that?
I do. This is an update that was done in 2017 where Ecology clarified this Shoreland Management Act does not apply to lands under exclusive federal jurisdiction. Right now in the SMP section 22-100-120B, NC discusses that the Shoreland Management Act applicability to federal lands, but does not clarify that federal lands are SMA exempt. So that it's essentially a clarification to the current SMP that we have to exclusively exclude federal lands from the Shoreland Management Act.
Okay, so if you look at page 8 of the consistency analysis, that explains a little bit more about what that bullet means. It's at the bottom of page 8.
Okay, I'll check that out. And so in Kitsap, we're talking specifically, maybe not all inclusive, but I'll mention, for example, Department and Navy installations, the bases, the fuel depot in Manchester. It would also include all federal lands, correct? So any U.S. Forestry Service property?
Yeah, that would include all five naval base Kitsap installations.
Okay, great, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, I don't see or hear anybody, so if you want to move on to the next section.
Yes. So the next section that I will cover include recommended actions. These are discretionary department recommendations, meaning they were proposed by staff after 6 years of applying the Shoreland Master Program and reviewing permits. These are recommended code changes and updates to help clarify, to help provide transparency, to help increase the functionality of the Shoreland Master Program. And so there are several topics that I will cover. Each topic has one or several proposed actions within each. And so I'll go line by line again, and please feel free to interject or stop, ask questions. when needed. So starting at the top, topic number four under definitions, the proposed or recommended action here is to clarify the definition for view blockage as well as building line. So right now, the view blockage definition is too specific, and clarity is needed for accessory structure view blockage definition. This is for internal consistency as well. Make sure we're consistent across all development regulations, our county codes. For the building line definition, the building line definition requires clarification as to what principal building refers to. So clarity is needed to specify that principal building does not include other shoreline accessory structures, such as boathouses or converted boathouses and accessory dwelling units.
This is often, planning commissioners, this is often an informal department director or assistant director requests on clarifications as the language is not clear to applicants and finding a path forward. So right here, we're trying to improve predictability for folks coming in and meeting those local codes.
And if you are following along in the consistency analysis document, we are now on the bottom of page or towards the middle of page 19 on row number 2, which has the specific code sections.
Yes, section 5 of the consistency report. All right, I'm going to move on to the next topic, and this is miscellaneous, topic number 5. This is to fix spelling, grammar, and correct any Scrivener's errors throughout the Shoreline Master Program. There are several errors in there that we want to make sure we correct during this periodic review. This is number 24, if you're following the consistency analysis report, it's number 24 in section 5, table 5. Moving on to the next topic, number 6, existing development. The proposed or recommended action here is to increase the timeline to rebuild development after accidental destruction or damage from 6 months to 365 days for reasonable timing for permit application. This proposed code change reduces burden on permit applicants and provides reasonable time to apply for permits, especially when the applicant has to deal with insurance policies and such.
We have run into instances where people just run out of time trying to close things out, especially if there's an investigation. And this all, and this 365 days also makes this consistent with our building code as well.
Moving on to vegetation conservation buffers. This is topic number 7, and there are several recommended actions under here. So the first is to apply buffer reduction review criteria consistently across all designations. The next recommended action here is to establish beach trams as a use in shoreline buffers and draft development regulations consistent with ecology's no-net loss policy. The next recommended action here is to establish standards for stair platforms and deck landings in geologically hazardous areas. The next recommended action here is to clarify which multi-use trail materials are pervious and which ones are not. There's clarity needed around gravel trails within the shoreline jurisdiction. The next recommended action here is to clarify or clearly indicate that allowed uses may require shoreline exemption permits. So even though it's an allowed use, you still need to document and apply for the shoreline exemption permits. That specific paperwork and process needs to occur, and that's not clear in our code currently. The next recommended action here is to revise regulations on viewing decks and platforms normally appurtenant to a single family residence. There is lack of clarity around viewing decks, which results in the misconception of these provisions within the SMP, and essentially leads to construction of abnormally large platforms and viewing decks. And those that completes all the recommended actions under topic number 7, vegetation conservation buffers. I'm gonna move on to topic number 8, water quality and quantity. Under here, we have one recommended action to match impervious surface limits in shoreline jurisdiction with the stormwater Title 12 stormwater drainage provisions. The next topic, 9, view blockage chapter. The recommended action here is to clarify diagrams for view blockage section to provide clarity around regulations for both county staff and permit applicants. Moving on to number 10, bulk and dimensional standards. The recommended action here is to resolve discrepancies between the Shoreline Master Program Development Standards Table and Title 17 Zoning Development Standards. We intend to update the chart to ensure consistency across all county codes. The next topic, process and enforcement. There are several under this topic. The first recommended action is to remove hearing examiner requirement for standalone shoreline substantial development permits to eliminate no value added permit processes. The next recommended action here is to evaluate and update the shoreline application flowchart. The next recommended action is to update minimum permit application requirements in the Shoreline Master Program, which right now does not include all shoreline and critical area information. So we recommend to update required submittals such as the site plan so that they include all the information needed to review for critical areas and buffers. The next recommended action here is to include Title 21 land use and development procedures, cross-reference where applicable to clarify shoreline permit review and time requirements. So again, this is a cross-reference, Title 21 land use and development procedures. And then topic 12, shoreline use and modification standards. There are several recommended actions under this topic as well. First is to add language to address commercial net pen provisions for non-native salmon operations pursuant to updates in state law regarding recent release of non-native salmon into Puget Sound. The recommended action here is to ensure consistency with the state law, House Bill 2957, which was recently passed in 2018.
And if you're following in the consistency analysis, this is on in the middle of page 23, row 19.
Row 19, yes. The next recommended action is to clarify replacement pilings to meet minimum spacing standards. This is row 20. And then the next recommended action is to clarify in code that subdivisions near but outside shoreline jurisdiction in certain circumstances should not be subject to a substantial development permit.
So this one probably deserves a little bit more explanation, Kirby. Do you want to do that or do you want me to?
Yes, I could do that. For shoreline parcels So in Kitsap County, we have a lot of shoreline parcels that are elongated like piano keys. And there are some actions out there where landowners subdivide that shoreline parcel and cut out the landward most of that shoreline parcel. And that subdivision, even though it does not intersect or cross into, or at least that new subdivided parcel does not intersect or cross into the shoreline jurisdiction or within the 200 buffer still trigger a substantial development permit. And so we did check with ecology in late October and got clarification that yes, those subdivisions of those parcels exclusively outside of the shoreline jurisdiction don't necessarily have to trigger a substantial development permit. This clarification in our code will add or remove a lot of no value added steps in our permit review process, save permit applicants a lot of money and time, as well as internal staff. The next recommended action is to define soft shore stabilization measures in the Shoreline Master Program per ecology guidance documents. This is row 22 of section 5. And then the last topic, number 13, special reports. This is to clarify that qualified professionals, as defined by the Shoreline Master Program, shall prepare all mitigation plans. So this is just to clarify that qualified professionals need to be preparing mitigation plans. And that summarizes all the mandatory and recommended actions that sets the stage really for developing and what we continue into the code writing phase of this process.
Hey, are there any questions of the staff regarding the discretionary department recommendations? Okay, Commissioner Phillips, unmute.
Okay, back on when we're doing permitting to rebuild after damage and that, it's going to go to 365. Main reason was because of insurance delays and stuff like that. If they reach the 365, then they have to reapply for another permit?
That is correct, to meet the current standards, depending on okay. When that original shoreline development was constructed.
Okay. Do we give any consideration to somebody that is essentially fighting insurance or, you know, having mitigating circumstances to extend beyond the 365?
I'm trying to think of an example in various codes that were, I don't think in the past year I've been with DCD, I've seen a particular example. Dave, have you?
Yeah, keep in mind this doesn't apply to zoning and site development as much as it does to rebuilding. So this brings the shoreline code into consistency with our building code. The time frame is longer for site development, but again, if you're rebuilding after a fire or after a disaster, it's basically building, not rebuilding, not a completely new site design or a change of land use or anything like that that would normally take longer. So this is entirely consistent. If we were getting into the land use side of things, it would probably take longer than a year, but so far a year seems to be working for the rebuild. The okay. 6 months just has not been working out because, especially if there's an investigation, that can stretch things out a little bit farther. And so the 6 months just has not been working for people.
Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions or comments? I don't see anybody. I think that's it right now. Great. Thank you very much, Kirby and Angie and Dave and Dan. Appreciate your being here tonight. Look forward to our next meeting on the subject. Okay.
Ms. Kirby, before we jump into the next agenda item, can we outline next steps on the schedule for everyone? Because
Thank you, Angie. I was just going to ask that.
So the next steps, right now we are preparing for our first project monthly update, which is scheduled for December 17. This is the third Thursday of the month. From 5:30 to 6:30, 1 hour virtual project update to provide project status and more information about this periodic process. We are also prepping for the same time around December 17 to launch our online open house. This will be essentially an extension to our established project website. It will include more in-depth information about the periodic process, the Shoreland Master Program, the comment periods, and provide a space for the public to dive more into the Shoreland Master Program and how to provide comments. That will go live in December, the same week as a monthly project update. And we are planning to refresh that online open house later in January in preparation for our February release of the code amendments for public review. And so right now we're shooting for February, which is in phase three. This is when we start the public comment period. This is when we release the code amendments for public review, and we'll update our online open house to include all those updated information. And then in terms of public outreach, in the last 2 weeks, we've sent out letters to key partners and interested parties, to tribal governments, and to member local associations and community groups, just providing more information about the periodic review process and inviting folks to engage and provide comments throughout the periodic process. And we're also offering consultations. In addition, we're also scheduling citizens advisory committee meetings in the next month or two to provide, again, an overview of this periodic review process. So more to come on all those fronts, and we'll continue to keep you updated and apprised of any new developments regarding this Shoreland Master Program.
Ms. Kirby, are we looking at March for the joint ecology as well as Planning Commission public hearing?
Yes. So in early February, we're still shooting for early February, which may extend into early March. So within that 30-day public comment period is when we're intending to have the joint ecology and planning commission public hearing event. There will be another public comment or formal public comment period associated with the Board of County Commissioners review and approval of the code of the proposed code amendments, which will take place in May through June.
Okay. One question about public participation. In addition to all the things you've outlined that you're doing, is it possible for the SMP and Buildable Lands program that we could send out at least one broadcast email to everybody on the county listserv about the project? And that may be in there now, I don't know. But I know right now, our most projects, you're just advertising it to those who subscribe, which is a much smaller number than the approximately, I think, 30,000 that are subscribed to all the various lists. Obviously, yes. I don't want to overdo it with too much inundation and unsolicited information. But
What we have typically done is when we're first launching a project, and we did this on the use table, for example, as well, we did do a very large broadcast. So we broadcast to all the gov delivery, we broadcast to all the next door sites. And so we do hit a very broad sector of the population. And then we also rely on those communications as also leveraging forward as well, because once we post it to say a next door site, we know that from experience that tends to get reposted in other locations as well. Then once we do a couple of those blasts, and those blasts usually have a link so you can sign up for topic specific communications, then we start to back off on those broad shotgun blasts and then allow people to say, yes, I want to know about the SMP. And then we'll gradually back away from the broad communications. And the reason for that is because we just don't want to pester people who don't want to hear about a particular topic.
Now, fantastic. I'm very supportive of what you're doing in that regard. Okay, great. Any other questions or comments? Okay, seeing and hearing none, we'll move to the next agenda item. Thanks again. Briefing, Buildable Lands Program update, Liz.
All right, good evening, commissioners. I have a very brief update this evening. I didn't want to take up too much of your time. Our plan is to come back in your next meeting and spend a little more time diving deep into the buildable lands program. So just kind of as a reminder, we've been coordinating with local cities, and Kitsap is one of seven counties in Washington required by the State's Growth Management Act to compile a buildable lands report. Kitsap County's is due by June 30th of 2021. The purpose and scope we've discussed in previous briefings with the Planning Commission, but just briefly, it is to look back at development trends between 2013 and 2019 to review if they are consistent with our countywide planning policies and local comprehensive plans. The report also looks forward to evaluate if there is adequate land supply in urban growth areas to accommodate and support future growth for both population and employment activities. And then in addition, if necessary, identify reasonable measures to address any inconsistencies that are found within that review and evaluation. So since the last Planning Commission meeting briefing on December 17th, a project announcement was sent out on November 20th via Gov Delivery, Nextdoor, Facebook, and Twitter, very similar to what we just discussed related to the SMP. This was a broad project announcement and encouraged folks to sign up for the project-specific page and future announcements related to this project. We are also working on implementing the other elements of the public participation plan, which includes those formal notifications to different key partners and interested parties identified in the public participation plan. As of the end of November, the county has compiled permit data for unincorporated Kitsap County and has received permit data from each of the jurisdictions for the look back at development trends. So DCD staff is currently summarizing that information. And then once this is complete or that summarization is complete, we will be sending that to Burke, who is the consultant team working with the county to support this effort. They will be completing a third party review an evaluation of consistency with the county's comprehensive plans and the countywide planning policies. So as it relates to the look forward evaluation or the look at land supply to accommodate future population and employment growth, over the last 2 weeks, the county has met one-on-one with each of the cities to review the previous steps or methodology and assumptions that were used by the different jurisdictions to evaluate land supply and whether or not it's adequate to accommodate future population and employment growth. These conversations also focused on how the methods and assumptions could incorporate some of the new statutory requirements that were established in 2017 as part of the Buildable Lands program. So since Kitsap's countywide planning policies require that jurisdictions use the same methodology for evaluating land supply, these conversations are really critical and helpful for understanding any changes that may be needed as we move forward. So based on these discussions and a review of the statutory requirements, Burke is currently developing recommended approaches for consideration, which will be discussed with jurisdictions at our next week's coordination meeting, which is scheduled for December 8th, which is Tuesday. And as I mentioned at the beginning, looking forward, our hope is to come back to the Planning Commission in at your next meeting and kind of walk through the different steps that are taken to look at land supply and evaluate that and also the assumptions that different jurisdictions use when looking at this, and then also how the county and cities might want to consider integrating some of the new statutory requirements as we finalize the methods for evaluating that land supply. So that's pretty much all I have at this point. Angie and Dave, feel free if I missed anything to add. But in terms of next steps, I think prepare yourself for a rather technical discussion at our next meeting because we'll get into the weeds on kind of the aspects of how we evaluate land supply at the county. In the past,
Christmas came, and some Christmas came for early consideration. That one was.
Huh? Yeah, I mean, I'm giving them a warning, so I feel as though it's appropriate.
It is not a really exciting technical conversation, but it's an important one to have as it's the laying the foundation of all of our, including cities and county, comprehensive plans and how we size our urban areas for the upcoming major comprehensive plan update in 2024, which it's due, so. Mm-hmm.
Okay, any questions or comments?
I have a question. Are the incorporated cities all pretty much in sync with the methodology that's being discussed?
Yeah, we haven't encountered any, we're right at that point where we're diving deep into all of those discussions. And I would say at this point, it seems as though there's some comfort level around our existing methods. However, it's just kind of how to consider some of those new statutory requirements and whether or not they do align with current steps of our existing methods. And so I think, time will tell after this next discussion. That's really our focus for the coordination meeting on the 8th. To identify and ensure that we are all on the same page and consistently moving forward with that methodology, which is a requirement for Kitsap's countywide planning policies. One of the things that we can get into a little bit is that the assumptions that are used within each one of the steps or the steps of the methodology, those can vary amongst jurisdictions and historically have. And so I think a lot of our discussions at this point have really focused in on that aspect of the buildable lands analysis versus the steps themselves. But we have, identified a few areas where we may want to consider some refinement, as this moves forward in the discussion. Angie or Dave, anything else to add on that?
I think it's safe to say that we're all for the most part pointed in the same direction, but there are just some nuances in how we get there. And as Liz said, there are assumptions built into this process from start to finish, and figuring out where we can align in those kinds of assumptions is very helpful in figuring out how we move forward. Mm-hmm. One that I'll point to and that I'll point to specifically is there was some discussion as to how do we deal with projects that are in the pipeline, meaning those that are actually in motion while we are actually doing the analysis and kind of stopping our data gathering process and processing and analyzing that data, but we know that there are still projects in process. How do we account for those kinds of things? So it's all that sort of nuance that we're trying to work through now. Okay.
That was a great question, Commissioner Svensson. Very informative. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Commissioner Beam.
Is there any, in your look back, is there any evaluation done on annexation plans and how successful they are or have we had any? I just can't remember since 2013, we've actually had much annexation going on.
Yeah, we have not had a ton of annexation in this evaluation period. I think when we discussed it recently, there was one that came to mind, was it Rocky Point area? And so that is part of this review and Burke is taking that into account as part of the kind of look at how that impacts the trends over time.
Yeah, every iteration of these analyses, we need to think about possible annexations and kind of look forward and try to read the tea leaves. But in recent years, they've been very few.
Which makes it difficult to define an urban growth area if there is no urban growth.
To define the edge effects, yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we still define urban growth areas within the county as well. Mm-hmm. They do expand beyond the city, but there is an implicit assumption in the Growth Management Act that eventually each of the cities will expand to fill urban growth areas, and we do see that on the other side of the water. But it's been less so here.
Yeah, I was going to say, not all, but a lot of the annexation petitions have failed as well, because a lot of the people might be inside that urban growth area, but they don't want to be part of the associated city. So that's a factor as well. Any other questions or comments? Okay, I don't see or hear any. Has there been, over the past 3 years, any changes in technology, GIS, any other map overlay improvements that'll be significant that could obviously affect the assumptions?
I believe that we have received some new, is it LIDAR data, Dave, which helps yes. to inform critical area buffers and assumptions related to that step and component. So there has been some new information available there. In addition, we've been one change in this evaluation period is all of the jurisdictions are now using SmartGov for their permit tracking systems. So from a kind of look back standpoint, it's nice that everyone has kind of a same system that they're utilizing for kind of collecting information related to this program. And then in terms of GIS and technology, we are, as part of our grant deliverables to Commerce, utilizing some technology to develop dashboards to help, provide kind of a visual representation of the information that's provided in the narrative report. So we're currently working on utilizing that to help, I guess, tell the story in a different fashion.
And to follow up on Liz's point on on the LIDAR, the last LIDAR flights that were done over Kitsap County were in late December, early January of 2017, 2018. And that is the latest and greatest that we have for most of Western Washington, because it was flown with by DNR and USGS, and Kitsap County paid for that service as well to make sure we get full coverage. That doesn't necessarily help us in the land use per se, but it does give us a much, much more high resolution and more well-defined image of what is happening on the ground in terms of locations of streams, locations of depressions, even constructed facilities appear in the LIDAR. And so it helps us to better integrate things, but it doesn't necessarily tell us a whole lot on the land use itself. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
It's been very useful in on the natural resources side of things.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Seeing and hearing none. Liz, could you give us the next steps? I know you talked a little bit earlier about it.
Yeah. So next steps, our next coordination meeting with the local jurisdictions is scheduled for next Tuesday, the 8th. We will be back to the Planning Commission in December to take a deeper dive into the methods and assumptions previously utilized. And then over the next kind of month or so, Burke will be doing that peer review of the look back data and evaluating if it's consistent with the assumptions in the countywide planning policies and comprehensive plans. And then we'll also be meeting with the board of county commissioners to have the same kind of conversation with them on kind of considerations moving forward related to the land capacity analysis.
Okay. Thank you, Liz. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll move to item H, good of the order, commissioner comments. The first one is public participation work group. And as you may recall at the previous meeting, we got into a discussion about the joint meeting with the Board of County Commissioners and the implications of the direction given by the commissioners regarding work groups. And as a result of our discussion, we requested of staff that they communicate with the county commissioners to get clarification regarding our work group and its interaction with external sources. Angie and staff have communicated with the commissioners, and I'll turn it over to Angie to quickly brief us about it.
Certainly. So thank you, Commissioner Eliason. We did reach out, as Mike mentioned, to the commissioners asking for clarification. We did hear back from two of the three commissioners on their perspective and interpretation of that email. And the general gist of that was it's okay for the work groups to solicit inputs from outside groups, but these work groups, again, need to maintain small numbers of specifically Planning Commission members to avoid those Open Public Meeting Act concerns when it comes to quorum issues. So again, not necessarily concerned per se about soliciting input, just be mindful of getting comments prior to the Planning Commission opening a public hearing, for example, on a particular proposal before you. So just again, those kind of sideboards that we've been working on for a number of years with this body. So I'm happy to answer any questions folks have or those have been working on the public participation work group that's currently established.
Okay. Basically, I don't see where the work groups would be, you know, their topics will be defined, you know, and as long as they stay within those, you know, getting that inputs and that should not raise any red flags, because we won't be in a commission meeting setting. So we won't be making any decisions or that. We, you know, bring forth a report of what the work group finds and presents that to the Planning Commission and that. So that works out. I was gonna say if, and leave it to Commissioner Beam, if he wants to tag along on this. Due to some of that confusion in that, the public participation group didn't get a real chance to go forward with it. We are going to meet, looks like we'll be able to meet this month to kind of help draw up a plan to help next year's group to move forward on this. We, you know, it's due to all sorts of circumstances that there was no real work group that got together per se. So now it's hopefully we can put our heads together, make a few recommendations, and next year possibly do another work group.
Okay, Commissioner Beam, did you have any comments to add to it?
No, sir, we're going to have a meeting on Monday. We'll go from there.
Okay, sounds good. And Commissioner Phelps, appreciate your work too, trying to organize a meeting. You know, there's been a lot of factors involved in putting it together. So, and as you guys know, the report date is December 31st, and you have a meeting next week, and hopefully you'll have more information for us at our final meeting of the year, which is December 15th, correct? Sounds great. And if you need any clarification, feel free to call the staff, Angie, and get it. I think everybody's going the same direction. So, okay. Any other comments from planning commissioners about the work group? Okay. 2021 regular meeting calendar. So this was another topic discussed at the last meeting about if the commission had to adopt it since we had different meeting dates from the regular schedule. Angie has consulted with the civil division of the prosecutor's office and has a report.
Thank you, Commissioner Eliason. After consultation with our legal counsel related to this, the question again is whether the Planning Commission needed to adopt their annual meeting agenda and schedule for the upcoming year, such as 2021. The simple response to that is no. However, it triggered kind of a series of questions about how we reschedule the follow-up meeting. So for example, in 2021, and Ms. Amanda, correct me if I'm wrong, there are a couple dates that we deviate from the first and third Tuesday meetings of the month, for example, election night, or if it falls within close proximity of a holiday and where we've had historically challenges meeting quorum. If we deviate from that first or third Tuesday meeting, let's say it's the first and second or the first and fourth, that deviation we actually need to notice more specifically as a special meeting per se. And that comes with special noticing requirements the clerk of the Planning Commission would need to prep and prepare for, but also it puts limitations on the amendments of the agendas at those specific meetings. So chime in, Ms. Amanda, if I missed any of that clarification that legal counsel followed up in a series of questions. What do you do when you notice another meeting and snowballed into, oh, okay, we will be doing that now.
So I think you covered it well.
So if we adopt an agenda meeting calendar and it is noted on that, you know, election night, we're going to do it the day after, it's still a special meeting?
So for, again, the Planning Commission doesn't need to take action on adopting agenda, the annual calendar, as that's already set up in the rules of procedure approved by the Board of County Commissioners. So the board actually approves your annual meeting calendar. What legal clarified is, again, let's say instead of that Tuesday, November 3rd or whatever election night is, if we want to schedule it for the following week or the day after, we have to follow special meeting notice procedures, which again, certain notice procedures Ms. Amanda needs to do, but also that limits on motions to amend or change that agenda. We have to specifically notice what that agenda is and not deviate from it. So it's an additional hurdle we'll have to follow.
So it'll be posted, you know, for the entire year as soon as it goes up there. But then as we come up to that date, we'll put out a special notice because it's technically either a regular meeting or a special meeting. There is no in between. So one or the other.
Yeah. We did the same Commissioner Phillips on that one. So
yeah, and there's not a lot to the statute. The statute reference in state law, a state recognized holiday, if the date falls on a holiday, then you can have the meeting the next day. But outside of that, it's a special meeting and you've got to provide notice. And then something for us to consider too, is that at a regular meeting, we can add items to a regular meeting agenda and take action. Whereas a special meeting, we cannot. It has to be on the agenda. You have to provide the 24 hours notice. It has to be given to every media that has on file a letter requesting meeting notices, et cetera. So a little bit more confined to have a special meeting. But as Amanda mentioned at another gathering, there's only a few of these during the course of a full calendar year out of, you know, basically two meetings a month. So it's special occasions.
One way to address it moving forward is modifying the rules of procedure and have to double check if the Planning Commission code also cross-references that first and third. I've worked on bylaw changes for advisory groups to build in that flexibility for modification based upon quorum and attendee availability. Sometimes it does make sense to slide that meeting regular business date for a variety of valid reasons.
Okay. Any other questions or comments about the calendar? Okay, we'll move on. 2021 chair and vice chair elections. Here we go again. Do we have any candidates willing to announce tonight? Not that you have to, this would be at the January meeting. You guys are as quiet as church mice. Although I think I just heard somebody's cat.
Yeah, I got a new one.
Oh, nice.
And he's thinking that he needs to rule the roost. Anyway,
it's just a reminder, placeholder we put on the calendar to get people thinking about it. And obviously next year we're going to have a different group. We have three we know of. Definitely going to miss the people we have right now, but we'll have three new appointees. Not sure. Have we had any updates from the commissioners about their appointment process? Specifically, if these will be done in December so that they're ready. I think our meeting's January 5th.
I have not heard anything, Commissioner Eliason. I know there's nothing posted for their upcoming December 7th regular business agenda. Haven't seen their last, which I think is the shortly after the following week to close out the year, but I have not heard any potential recommendations to the full board or anything of that, unfortunately.
Okay. Great, so I guess nobody's announcing tonight. Any other good of the order or commissioner comments from anyone? Okay, that's it. So is there a motion to adjourn?
Move to adjourn.
Okay, motion from Phillips and Commissioner Allen seconded the motion. Sorry, you were on mute.
But she had her hand
up. And we can see her, yes.
Second.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, motion and second to adjourn. All those in favor say aye and raise your hand, please.
Aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. Meeting adjourned at 6:43 p.m. We'll see everybody at the next meeting.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good evening.
Next time we'll do it all in pantomime.
All right, Dave.